Over the next few weeks, New Yorkers will have lots of opportunities to see Willem Dafoe at the IFC and Bam Rose Cinemas, where he's appearing on film as a psychiatrist in Lars von Trier's Antichrist. On stage at the Public Theater, where until December 13th he'll be playing the title role in Richard Foreman's Idiot Savant. And soon his voice will be in theaters all over town as security guard Rat in Wes Anderson's stop-action animation adaptation of Roald Dahl's children's classic Fantastic Mr. Fox. And at this moment, he is on our show. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
There's no evident typecasting in that range of roles. I'm tempted to start with, will the real Willem Dafoe stand up?
Well, that's always a good question for me. Who that is.
But that's one of the reasons, I guess, some people get into acting.
I think so.
Well, along with the 70 or so films that you've made, haven't you tried to maintain a parallel career in avant-garde theater over the years ever since, I think, you came to New York from Wisconsin in the 70s?
Right. I wouldn't even say a parallel career. I mean, it really, the theater came first. And I was a theater actor first, and that was my identity. And then for many years, I was working with the Wooster Group, and that was a place that I went every day. I mean, that was my work.
And I mean, while you were making the films, you'd go back.
Yeah, but day in, day out, I was at the Wooster Group, helping to run the place, helping to make the pieces, and performing, of course, and maybe going off once or twice a year to do a movie, sometimes for a short time, sometimes for a long time. But that was pretty much my life for 25 years.
Until 6 years ago.
Until
when
6 years ago.
You broke with the Wooster Group.
Right.
We're not going to get into the circumstances. It's
well,
it's boring.
Just, yeah, it's the short story is I separated from the director personally. We were a couple. And it seemed best not to work together. And somehow we've never come back together.
Now, you had worked with Richard Foreman before.
I had, yes. Actually, at the Wooster Group with some of the other Wooster Group actors, I think almost 20 years ago.
I think it was more, like 85 or something like that.
I don't know.
But he wasn't calling it the hysterical ontological theater at that
point. He was. Yeah, he was. The ontological hysteric theater
dates
back to, the 60s.
He said that his choice of you for the part in Idiot Savant was primarily a musical thing. It's just the sound of Willem's voice, the rhythms of his speech that I thought could be adapted to this, he said. And it helped that you seem to be up for anything.
Ah, well, I certainly, I'm a great fan of his. And I had worked with him before, but I think a lot of what he did was lost on me then. I feel like I'm more, I'm able to take in more now, and I feel like I can serve his ideas better, his way of working better than I could before.
People who don't understand how actors work often ask, how do you memorize all those lines? and usually that's a silly question. But with Beckett and Foreman, it does become a real question, doesn't it? Because so many of the things are non sequiturs.
It's true. In this case, it's just, before we even rehearse, before we have our first meeting, he requires that we have the text committed to heart. So normally you learn your text by association with the actions as you stage it. It becomes a natural thing. There's a logic. But he does not work with a traditional narrative, so you don't often have the blocking or the narrative to make the association. So to learn the text in this case, you just have to learn it just abstractly as a series of words and create your associations.
Well, although I read it as being about the nature of language and God, among other things, there's an awful lot of physical comedy in this production.
It's true.
And a giant duck.
Yes.
And the idiot savant you play is something of an innocent who gets knocked around a bit. I'm not sure whether we'd call it slapstick or not, but
right.
That is that's something you haven't done a lot.
Actually,
or have you done it all in theater?
I have mostly in theater. And certainly I've, I don't have much opportunity to do like broad physical comedy in film, although as I get older and my options get kind of wider, I have started to do more comedy.
You have these wonderful Socratic dialogues with your co-stars, Alina Lowenson and Alenka Krager. But there are all of these things that we've come to associate with Richard Foreman plays, like loud musical cues, the sound of breaking glass.
Yes.
There's an omniscient narrator. Hasn't he said that this will be his last work for the stage?
Yes, because he's interested in making experimental film.
But he's vowed that before, hasn't he?
Exactly, exactly. It may be just a technique to keep on keeping on. I don't know. But he swears that it's for real this time, but we'll see.
Well, I don't think you've ever threatened to retire, but Lars
Never.
Von Trier has also talked about retirement.
Yeah, I do see some through line in these guys.
Well, that was my clever segue here.
Yeah, well, they both make very personal work and very demanding work. They're very demanding on themselves, and I think it's difficult when you're not a careerist and you don't walk away from your work. It is your life. These people, in order to, as I jokingly said, keep on going, keep on keeping on, they have to trick themselves into only dealing with what's in front of them. And as an actor, I relate to that.
Well, he has lots of phobias, so I guess I shouldn't be surprised that the character you play in Antichrist is a psychiatrist.
Right, right. It's in fact, it's the therapy used is modeled on therapy that Lars has had. And in preparation for the film, he encouraged me to get in touch with, he hooked me up with some people so I could understand the generally what the therapy he went through was.
But you observed things here at Columbia, didn't you?
I did. There's some very good cognitive behavior theory therapy people consented to let me sit in on some sessions and also were very helpful in pointing me towards some information so I could understand the ideas and the language of this therapy.
He also did something about therapy in The Idiots, didn't he?
I saw The Idiots. I can't remember so much. I remember that being more kind of cultish.
Yeah. Well, some people are saying that that because of the way that the therapist here treats his wife, well, we'll get to that in a moment.
Yes.
But the treatment is so disastrous, it's easy to read this film as an indictment of psychoanalysis.
I think, you know, he doesn't come off very well, but the understanding is that one of the reasons the therapy fails is he breaks a basic ethical law that you shouldn't treat your people close to you because you don't have the distance. You become involved, and then you get sucked. You lose your objectivity.
Well, you've talked in the past about liking to play villains, but this guy isn't a villain, but he is also
not
a hero here.
No, and I like that. I mean, I can't separate. You know, they're a couple, and with only two actors in this movie, they become the story. So I try not to judge the characters anyway. But in this one, I couldn't separate him from her, from the fox, from the woods, from anything. So I didn't have that kind of judgment. And in fact, I was a little surprised when I was reading some things and hearing some reactions that people are very tough on this guy when he really does. He's a rationalist that does the best he can to try to help his wife.
Well, there's a certain amount of arrogance in the way he approaches it, and it obviously is not working. And in fact, she resists. The wife resists at first, but we don't get a sense of just how disturbed she is until she declares herself cured.
Right.
Well, we should back up a bit.
Okay.
Because you said this was based on some therapy that Lars von Trier, the writer-director,
yes,
went through. We hope he didn't go through this experience. The psychiatrist and his writer-wife, who's played by Charlotte Gainsbourg, who won the Best Actress Award
at
Cannes.
She did.
They're grieving over the death of their only son who fell from a window while they were making love.
Yes.
And they have to deal with both their grief and feelings of guilt, and she has a breakdown.
Yes.
And we understand why that would be, but
sure.
She seems to be even more overwhelmed than most people. She just cannot
put
it together.
She almost to the point of catatonia. I mean, she's in terrible trouble. She can't get out of the depression, and I think he's desperate, and he takes the only option he can see, and that is get her off the meds and take her out to the retreat that they have and try to be with her and help her to see the patterns of her thinking and try to beat this these phobias that have arisen out of the depression.
Now, you know that there are women who will tell you that Lars von Trier is a misogynist, because in this film, in Breaking the Waves, Dancer in the Dark, the women are all spiraling into delusion.
But he also is telling women's stories. I mean, the principal characters, the heroines, are, they're women at the center of his films. It didn't occur to me. He's tough on women, but he's even tougher on men.
You've said that you saw the project as a challenge to strike the right balance between controlling yourself and letting yourself go. You said one man's hammy overacting is another man's passionate acting. One man's boring, flat, walk-through performance is another man's beautifully restrained performance. Mm. That is different in film than on stage, isn't it? The famous Eisenstein experiments,
yes,
where he showed the same face,
yes,
in front of different,
yes,
things,
yes,
that people interpreted it all as great acting.
Well, basically, you know, in film, obviously, it's a director's medium, it's a editor's medium, but the material has to be created, and the quality of the material, the integrity of the material is what they're working with, and the actors are often the material. So I'm not sure it relates to exactly what you quoted there, but, you know, my job is always to try to find I see what we're doing, and I try to inhabit a way that serves the vision and serves the world and serves what we're trying to do. Sometimes it's driven by narrative, sometimes it's a little more poetic. Part of my job is to figure out how to explore in a full way what we're doing.
And you've spoken of how many actors have a not-so-secret desire to expose themselves emotionally and, in some cases, literally, which
yes,
you've done a few times,
yes,
in your career as well.
Why not?
And how does that work here? I'm not sure I see that as much in Idiot Savant, and definitely I'm not sure that it comes into play when you're playing security guard Rat. But
it's all exposing yourself. It's all flirting with the myth of personality. It's all, you know, entertaining someone else's set of values or way of seeing. So anytime you do that, it's a little risky.
My guess is Willem Dafoe, who likes to take risks, many directors will tell you, he is currently appearing in Antichrist, Lars von Trier's film, which is being shown at the IFC and Bam Rose Cinemas. He's also playing the title role in Richard Foreman's Idiot Savant, or Idiot Savant, if you're doing the French pronunciation. And that is at the Public Theater through the 13th.
Yes.
And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us.
Okay.
We're back with Willem Dafoe, who is currently appearing at the Public Theater in Richard Foreman's play. Richard Foreman says it's his last play, but we'll see. It's called Idiot Savant, and it runs until December 13th. And he's also starring with Charlotte Gainsbourg in Antichrist, Lars von Trier's controversial film, which is currently being screened at the IFC and Bam Rose Cinemas. You have a history of playing difficult characters for great but demanding directors, Paul Schrader, Werner Herzog, Abel Ferrara, Theodoros Angelopoulos, Oliver Stone, Spike Lee, Martin Scorsese, Sam Raimi, an impressive list. First of all, do you choose directors that you want to work with?
I'm attracted to strong directors. Yeah.
Well, what distinguishes Lars von Trier? Because you also appeared in Mandalay.
I did. Lars is, you know, it's hard to compare, so I can only talk about Lars by himself. He's he's really, you know, these are people I want to be around. Lars is good company. He's intelligent. He's challenging. He's a great artist. He's fun to work with. I think he has a real knack for cutting through a certain kind of politeness, and he's like a heat-seeking missile for the taboo, and he really, you know, makes things that I think challenge.
And he says that he cast you in Antichrist after you sent him an email message asking what he was working on, but obviously you have a different take on him than Nicole Kidman, who after Dogville was quoted as saying she not only didn't want to act for von Trier again, she never wanted to speak to him again.
You know.
Is he people, hard on some actors?
People say a lot of things. I'm sure she would like to take that back. I would imagine.
Mm. Have Lars, you ever felt that
Lars
way?
Lars is a lovely guy. About him?
No, about somebody you'd worked with?
No.
Because there were some directors.
There's some people that disappoint, you know, because you're, you know, always in films. You're making something, and then someone takes what you make and turn it into something else. Sometimes they improve on what you did. Sometimes they can sync what you did.
I've had actors tell me that they thought they did a great scene, and then when they saw the scene, it had been edited in a way where maybe the worst take or their best moment didn't even appear on screen.
Yeah, but I try not to even think in those terms. I mean, it's all done to make this thing, and you know. You just keep working away. You can't hang on to those things that you think are good.
Hmm. Well, I was thinking about Otto Preminger, who many actors complained about, and then I look at the films and I think, well, gee, I would have been proud to have been in some of those films.
Exactly. I mean, you know, you hear Bjork complaining about Lars, but he made a beautiful thing for her to do in that movie, Dancer in the Dark.
And she gives a great performance of a singer who winds up doing incredible acting.
Yes, and I'm sure it would have been hard, and she may have judgments about the guy, but what they made together was interesting.
Are you surprised by how much he has broken his own rules? Because he was the founder of Dogma 95. For example, one of the rules there was that music has to occur naturally as part of the film.
Right.
You turn on the radio and you hear the music. Yes. Here he has a score.
Yes, but this is outside of his Dogma work. That was just a rule. That was a certification for a certain kind of filmmaking. And he never pretended this was Dogma. He's not married to that for life. That was just one particular form.
I haven't done research on this, but you may be the only actor to have appeared in two films with Christ's name in the title.
One,
of course, you're not the Antichrist.
No, I'm not.
But in Martin Scorsese's The Last Temptation of Christ,
I did play Christ. Yes.
And you've played numerous psychopaths over the years. In this film, you play a psychotherapist. I don't know whether we're seeing some kind of theme here.
I don't know. I can't, you know, the trick is how am I changing and how is everything else changing? So I don't even ask myself those things.
Well,
you've been patterns.
You've been in such a wide range of films.
Yes.
But most people remember the nasty characters you've played.
Well, I tend to play heavies or more character roles in more widely seen films because, you know, when you have success with something, they want you to repeat that success in the commercial filmmaking world. And sometimes the more challenging and the more interesting opportunities, which sometimes fail, you know, come in the smaller films, the independent world. So those are films that are probably less seen.
There are also some actors who don't want to play bad guys. In fact, if I remember correctly, Humphrey Bogart got his big break because George Raft didn't want to play a character who died at the end of the movie.
Wow. Well, that's I think that's a different system. That's talking about movie stars, not actors.
Is it true that Jack Nicholson wouldn't have been cast as the Joker in the Batman movie if you hadn't turned Tim Burton down?
No, this is not true.
That's all over
it's
the internet.
Like, I know. You know, the funny thing about the internet is there's nobody checking it. You know, stuff gets in there, and it stays there, and it just grows. I made some casual comment that in one of the early Batmans, there was a inquiry about my interest in playing Batman. It wasn't an offer. It was just one of these things gets floated.
Would you have wanted to do that?
And the reporter? I didn't follow it up in such a way that... But who knows what I was doing? I may have been busy at the theater, as crazy as that sounds.
So the reporter,
whether they did it willfully or whether it was just a misunderstanding, ran with it, and then it got kind of morphed from the Batman thing to me being offered the Joker, because once upon a time someone said that their first choice was me for the Joker. That's all I know about that. But it's one of those little things you say in an interview. Someone gets it as a soundbite after you give a half an hour interview. They only run that one little piece. It goes on the internet, and then it keeps on getting removed about three times, and then before you know it, it's a flat-out distortion.
Well, all throughout the internet, there are all these flattering remarks about how you are willing to take chances. Mm-hmm. And Paul Schrader says, with Willem, you can actually say, this guy is such a loser, and he'll get it and say, isn't that great? He'll play a loser like a loser.
You know, I think part of, you know...
He gave you a nasty role in Autofocus, I have to tell
you. He did, but it was a beautiful role.
And, a loser who was also a nasty guy.
Yes and no. I mean, part of the thing, you know, acting is somehow, you know, an exercise in empathy. And it's taking on that guy's saying to yourself, you know, if my life was different, I could be this guy. And what would I do? And you sort of entertain his circumstances, and you try to humanize them normally. And I like doing that. And I don't try to judge them. I try not to, you know, I just try to find something that lets you entertain a different way of viewing the world.
Well, how does that apply to the role of Tars Tarkas, the Martian warrior in John Carter of Mars? Filmed that?
No. I'm just starting, so I can't really speak to that so much.
You'll be 9 feet tall, have 4 arms, and speak the language of the green Martian people.
Yes, of course. I'm really looking forward to it. It's with great people, and it's great material, and it should be exciting. Because we'll have to invent some things.
Directed by Andrew Stanton of WALL-E fame.
And also Finding Nemo, which I worked with him on.
Uh-huh. And this is Edgar Rice Burroughs?
Yes. Uh-huh. It's from a series of this John Carter of Mars series. And it's this first part is based on Princess of Mars, I think, the first book.
And the run for Idiot Savant ends on December 13th?
Yeah, there may be a chance of extending a little bit, but not much beyond that.
You know? And then you probably have a film to do.
Then I start John Carter of Mars.
But right now we have Willem Dafoe in Antichrist, which is currently screened at the IFC and Bam Rose Cinemas, and he's appearing live in Idiot Savant at the Public Theater. And it has been my great pleasure to talk with him today on our show.
Thank you so much. Yeah, okay.
On tomorrow's show, David Plouffe on how the Obama campaign developed its unique strategies for the 2008 presidential race. And then Frederick Wiseman on his latest documentary about the Paris Opera Ballet. Also, photographer Joel Meyerowitz on his pictures of the hidden pockets of wilderness in New York City. And historian Neil Ferguson on the evolution of our financial system. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Fran Jacobs. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow. ¶¶